Turn to Luke chapter 22. We're going to look at a passage this morning that is probably one of the most incredible passages, as I see the incredible contrast between that of these people determined to put Jesus to death, that they have to break so many of their own laws that they so highly regarded themselves in keeping, in order just to deny justice, deny the truth, just to get this guy killed. And on the other side, you've got Jesus, who has the power at any moment to say, you know, I am and you were. And that would have been it. They'd have been done. And yet he willingly lays down his life. It's a fascinating passage as I consider the Lord's love toward us. Now, the scriptures speak, when you compare all four gospels, you find out that there are actually six trials, no less than six trials that Jesus underwent before he went to the cross. And in fact, each one of these trials, there's a travesty of justice. Justice is not met. There is a determination by those who want Jesus dead to break any laws they can to put him there. Now, Luke does not get into any detail about the first two trials. He does mention in verse 54 when they arrested and they led him to the high priest's house, but he doesn't go into any detail about that trial, where the other gospel accounts give us a little. The very first one was when they brought him to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the former high priest from A.D. 6 to A.D. 15, and then eventually held an honorary position as high priest while his sons kind of acted in the official role, and now his son-in-law, Caiaphas, is there. When Annas asked Jesus about his disciples and his teaching, Jesus replied saying, well, you know, I spoke openly in the public square. Everybody heard me. If you want to know what I said, ask them. And of course, he had one of the servants strike Jesus on the mouth, which was against the law. Then finally he was brought to Caiaphas, and that was what verse 54 mentioned. They led him and brought him to Caiaphas, and then we kind of deviated to look at what Peter had happened to him in the courtyard. While that court case was going on the inside, Peter on the outside was struggling with, you know, confessing Jesus and eventually denied him. Now during that trial, Caiaphas asked Jesus, eventually, you know, very straightforward, are you the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God? And Jesus replied, you said it. Now, sometimes when we say that in the English, what we're implying is, you said it, not me. I didn't say that. But that's not what is implied at all in what Jesus says. In fact, it's a very plain testimony that's, you've got it right. That's it. You said it, and that's true. And it's amazing that Caiaphas, even on an earlier occasion, had predicted. Now, the scriptures speak that the high priest would have been given that opportunity to prophesy, and Caiaphas certainly was not a godly man, though he was the high priest. Yet he does prophesy, though he did it unknowingly. He said to the other Pharisees when they were discussing what to do with Jesus, he said, you guys don't know anything. It's expedient that one man should die and not the whole nation die. He said that in John 11:50. And what he meant was, if we don't kill Jesus, then he's our whole nation, our whole position in this nation is going to be ruined. Everyone's going to follow him, and we're going to all be lost. And so he said, better he die than we die. Well, what God was intending him to say was that unless Jesus dies, then the whole nation would perish. It's Jesus' death that's going to open the door for salvation, not just to the Jewish people, but also to the Gentiles. And yet after this trial, when they asked him out front, are you the Christ? And Jesus made that good confession and says, yes, under oath he did. Most of the trial he's silent, but during that time when he's asked directly, when the high priest says, I adjure you that you answer and you tell us plainly, are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God? And Jesus said, you said I am, and you're right. Well, then he said, well, what further need do we have witnesses? And at that point, then we come into verse 63 where we left off. And it says, the men who held Jesus then mocked him and beat him. You see, they had this trial. It was in the middle of the night. It was an illegal trial, but they held it. And now they've determined he's guilty. He's claiming to be the Son of God. And of course, they didn't believe that, so they thought it was blasphemy, and that was the crime for which they're going to charge him. And so they mocked him then, Q, the Son of God, and they beat him. And having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, "Prophesy, who is the one who struck you?" Now, when you get hit, generally, if you see a punch coming, you can roll with the punch. It's when you're blindsided that's when damage really occurs. In sports, too, especially, you know, when you're you've got this 300-pound tackle coming towards you and you're ready to get hit, you roll with the punch. You know you're going to get hit, so you kind of roll with it, and it takes away some of the pain, although not all of it. At the same time, when that 300-pound tackle is coming at you from behind and you don't see them coming, then you can seriously get injured. Jesus is blindfolded and he can't see the blows coming, and all of a sudden they come, and that damage that could have been done is tremendous. But then they add insult to the injury by saying, "Prophesy to us, O Son of God. Who is it that struck you?" You know, the intriguing thing to me is he didn't answer. He could have. He could have told them exactly who it was who hit him. He could have said, "Yeah, I know who your name is, and I know your wife and your three children just down the street, and I know all about you, and I know when you stole your employer's money last week," and I know. He could have told the whole guy's history. Amazing that he didn't. Because you know why? He was willingly laying his life down. He did not want to give them a sign. He did not want to give them anything. Their minds were made up. And it says many other things they blasphemously spoke against him, like, "Physician, heal yourself. If you healed others, heal yourself." Peter tells us that when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. And when he was suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. He laid his life down for the sheep. The amazing thing here. Well, now they basically have made their mind up about him. They've already judged him, but they have to go through the formality of a legal trial. They know that that would not stand up in their records. They have to have the whole Sanhedrin, the whole council together. So as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." Now, they've already asked him the question in the night trial. They've already went through all this, but now they're just going to cut to the chase. You know, they're going to have a quick meeting with the council. And so now they want him to say it again. Well, he says, if I tell you, you'll by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you'll by no means answer me or let me go. He's already learned that's to be the case. And hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. So he does confess it once again. You'll see the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Lest you think, when you're reading the Scriptures, that when you come across the phrase Son of Man, that you think, wait, does that mean he's really not claiming to be the Son of God, but he's saying he's the Son of Man? Lest you would think that, understand this foundation of what he's saying with this is very clearly a testimony of being the Son of God. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 through 14 says this, "I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near to him, and he was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed." That is referencing to the Messiah, the Holy One of Israel, as the Son of Man. He is the Son of Man in Matthew 13 when he speaks of himself, saying, "The Son of Man will send out his angels and they'll gather out of his kingdom all things that offend who practice lawlessness." Amazing, he says the Son of Man will gather his angels. Whose angels are they? They're God's angels. Who's the Son of Man then? He is the Son of God. You see, he had to be the Son of God in order to have the holiness in which to stand in our place. But he had to be the Son of Man also in that he could be that perfect sacrifice, that he could identify with us. But the Son of Man is a reference to the Son of God. And of course, they understand that because they respond. Notice how they respond. They said, "Are you then the Son of God?" They just want to clarify it because that's what they heard. And he said to them, "You rightly say that I am." You say that I am literally is what he's saying, but the translators put that rightly in there so that you don't confuse that from the language. It's a very, very bold claim to say, "Yes, this is who I am." And then they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." Jesus makes a very clear claim to be the Son of God here. He makes a very clear claim, and that cannot be misunderstood. There are people who say, well, I don't think Jesus ever really claimed that. Well, you can't come to any other conclusion because that's what his enemies heard, and that's why they charged him with blasphemy, because they didn't believe that. You, being a man, make yourself out to be God? You, the Son of God? And they did not believe it. He had no form or comeliness or appearance that people should desire him. He looked like a plain, average-looking Jew of his day. And unless people really had eyes of faith, they couldn't see. But, of course, all the miracles that he did and the fulfillment of Scripture and the fact they could find nothing wrong in him. No, as closely as they scrutinized him for 3 years. Imagine the media doing that to you for 3 years, watching every move you make, watching for you just to make one slip up. Couldn't find anything in him. Well, when we come to that conclusion, we have to realize just who Jesus is. He's the Son of God. Now, since he says that, and he makes that claim very clearly, there's two alternatives. Those claims that he made of being the Son of God, they're either true or they're false. It is either true that he is the Son of God, or they're false. He's not the Son of God. Those are the only alternatives. Let's just say for a moment that his claims were false, that he really wasn't the Son of God. There's two possibilities. He either knew he wasn't, or he didn't know that he wasn't. If he wasn't the Son of God, he either knew it or he didn't know it. Now, if he knew he wasn't the Son of God and yet claimed to be the Son of God, what would that make him? A liar. If you knew something's not true and you're saying it anyway, you're a liar. If the other alternative is possible, that he wasn't the Son of God but he didn't know it, he thought he really was the Son of God, what would that make him? Crazy. Exactly. Now, those are the only alternatives if he wasn't the Son of God, because he claimed to be, but if he wasn't, then he was either a liar or he was a lunatic. Now, there are people who come up with this nonsense about Jesus being a good moral teacher. But it is utterly nonsense, because when you look at all of his claims and what he said, speaking about his angels coming and that he's going to raise on the third day and that, you know, he predicted the end and he was going to come back in glory. And I mean, he predicted all these things. If that were not the case, then he's either a liar or he's crazy. There is no option for him being a good man, you see, unless his claims are true. Then, of course, it fits. See, now, folks, there's the only option you have. He either is Lord, or he is a liar or a lunatic. Those are the only options you've got. You cannot say he was a good moral man, a good prophet, as everyone says, well, I believe Jesus was a prophet. Really? Well, if he prophesied such things and they were not true, what would that make him? See, this is the thing we've got to conclude. Now, very plainly, he makes those claims. And, of course, these people are now using this against him, and they've kind of forced him. And, in fact, this is the travesty of justice in these trials. And I want you to see this, see the hardness of men's heart. Maybe you won't recognize this, but if you compared what's going on in these trials with what we would conduct in our legal system, or British legal system, or any Western cultural legal system where you have strong jurisprudence, the basis to evaluate a case. And in fact, there have been lawyers who have evaluated this case and have found a number of things that would have caused this thing to be thrown out of court. For example, the fact is that they went in search of witnesses against Jesus. Right there, they would have been thrown out of court. When you accuse someone, if you went to jail for something, or you were arrested for something, and you were going to go to court, and the court began to try to find witnesses against you, not witnesses for you, but just witnesses against you, that would be thrown out of court, just like that. Another thing is, they brought Jesus before this man who had no authority, and they questioned him, not even having any legal counsel with him. He'd be thrown out of court, just like that. Tried to force him to testify against himself, thrown out of court. They beat him before a legal trial, tossed that baby out. This would not have stood up in any court system. The witnesses couldn't agree, the other gospel testimonies tell us. That they tried to find witnesses, they couldn't find any. Then they brought some false witnesses in, and they were saying things like, well, he said he was going to destroy the temple. He never said that. When he was in the temple, he said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it again. It was a metaphor for his body. And they understood that he wasn't saying to someone, destroy the temple, but they twisted the words. You know, it's like if you're in court and you're sitting there and a lawyer comes up to you and says, have you stopped beating your wife? Yes or no? Answer. Well, if you say yes, that means you were beating your wife. If you say no, that means you're still beating her. So, I mean, either way you answer, you're going to be hit. Well, that's kind of how it is. It was kind of like this old guy who was brought to court and, he was questioned over some injuries that he had sustained. And what had happened was, I've totally forgot this illustration, so let's go on. It was coming and then it just went gone. So if it comes back, I'll tell you. But, you know, just thinking of this court case, again, it would not have stood up. And yet the travesty of justice is this. The judges also assume the role of prosecuting attorneys. The leaders are attempting to destroy him. He's forced to make a statement. And now he's made the statement that they can charge him with blasphemy and thus accuse him and put him to death. Only one problem. They don't have the authority to put anyone to death legally. That right to capital punishment has been removed from them by the Roman authorities. So in order to put him to death, they have to bring him before the Roman authorities. So he's had three trials already, one before Annas, one before Caiaphas, and one before the Sanhedrin. And they've concluded, you're guilty. Now they have to find a way to convince the Romans to put him to death because they have no authority to. I find this interesting because later on when Stephen was preaching the gospel, they just spontaneously stone him. So they were able to, but I think that in this case they were so afraid of the people, they wanted to make sure it was the Romans who did it so they wouldn't get blamed. So then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him. Now, Pilate is the Roman procurator of that time. For many, many years, the critics of the Bible said, you know, all the stories in the Bible, they're just fairy tales. We have no evidence for any of these people ever existing. We don't know that. We've never seen their names in any records of Rome. We've never seen any of these things. You know, but that really doesn't tell you a lot because you can't make an argument from silence. You know, just because you haven't found it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. The amazing thing is, though, you can go to Israel now, and when you go to Caesarea by the sea, you can find a copy of an inscription that they found, the actual one is in the museum, on stone, of Pontius Pilate dedicating that theater to Caesar. And they've got his name, Pontius Pilate. So they found him. And this is a relatively recent discovery in the last 30 years, so it's rather an exciting discovery because it just... You know, the Bible was right all along. We already knew that. It just takes a little time for science and, you know, technology and archaeology to catch up to what the Bible has already said. But the amazing thing is this guy was really, they found another thing about him. He's the fifth procurator of Samaria and Judea, and they found a letter by Philo quoting him, quoting actually Agrippa 1 about him, that describing him as a merciless, obstinate, and very inflexible man. Now, the scriptures show us that he was proud and cruel. That's beyond a fact, but he was also superstitious. Later, his wife will have a dream this very night about Jesus, and she'll come to him and warn him, don't have anything to do with this man. So that's why you kind of see Pilate's very hesitant to just give him over to the Jews' desire to kill him. He had no love for the Jewish leaders. There was a lot of strained relations already between the Jews and the Romans, and he didn't help matters because of some of his policies. But ultimately, he was afraid of them, so they influenced him to do this dirty deed. It's funny, when they first come to him, Luke doesn't tell us, but they bring Jesus to him, and they're saying, you know, we want this man put to death. And Pilate says, well, what are the charges? What has he done? And they said, well, if you weren't an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him to you. And I can imagine that conversation going on. You can see the animosity there. Just kill him, you know. You don't need to know anything. Well, Pilate wasn't going to just let them push him over like that. So he won the charges. And now they know they're going to have to get formal charges against him. And they also know, if we go to Pilate and say, this man blasphemed, you know, our God, Pilate's going to say, get out of my court. I don't care about your religious laws. So very shrewdly, They've got to turn this into a political thing. So they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow, number one, perverting the nation. He's seditious. He's upsetting things. He's misleading people. Secondly," they say, "and he's forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar." Now, is that a lie or what? I mean, didn't we just learn that when they tried to trap him into saying that, and they says, "Should we pay taxes or not?" And Jesus says, "Show me a coin." And he said, "Whose inscription?" "Caesar's." "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." In other words, pay your taxes. But render to God the things that are God's. And of course, they couldn't trap him, so it didn't work. And they marveled at his answer. But now they're just openly lying. And then thirdly, they're saying, he says, saying that he himself is Christ. And of course, just so that Pilate will understand the implication of that Christ, or that's the Greek word, Christos, from which comes from the Hebrew word Messiah. Just so you'll understand that, the Hebrew word Mashiach, actually, which we get the English Messiah. He says, a king. He wants to make sure Pilate hears that little buzzword, king. Well, Pilate then asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, Luke abbreviates so much here. We don't know. I mean, this is not just exactly how it happened. He's abbreviating a lot. There was a lot more in this. Other Gospels give us a little, but there was a good amount of time where Pilate examined him, and Luke tells us that he examined him very carefully, but he doesn't give us all the details about it. But he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "It is as you say." Now, according to John's Gospel, he took them aside, pulled them inside, and talked to him quite at length about this and asked him about this. And Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. For if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would come and fight and defend me. But since it's not of this world, you know, I'm not a king." Well, Pilate understood that he had no political aspirations at all. In fact, before, when Jesus had healed some people and also did some miracles of feeding of the 5,000, remember, they tried to force him to be king. And he slipped out of their midst. He would not be king. He had no political aspirations. And Pilate can see this very plainly. So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." There's no fault here. Now right there, the court case should have been over. He was acquitted. Get out of my sight. There's no fault. There's nothing wrong with him. But notice, but they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea and beginning from Galilee to this place. He's an insurrectionist. He's stirring up things in your kingdom." And you know, they throw another little code word in there, Galilee. Now, why did they do that? Well, if you knew anything about Pilate's history with the Galileans, you'd know that Pilate he didn't like the Galileans at all. They were troublemakers up there. He had killed a number of them while they were sacrificing in the temple, mixing their blood with the sacrifices, just mercilessly, just coming in and slaughtering them. He had a lot of trouble with those up in Galilee. There were a lot of people leading people in rebellion against Rome. And so now, just throwing that little Galilee in there, maybe that'll make Pilate change his tune. Well, unfortunately, it's turned on them. And when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man was a Galilean. As soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. It totally makes sense he'd be in Jerusalem at that time, because half of his kingdom is in Jerusalem now, because everybody from all over would come to Jerusalem for the feast. So Herod was there also, probably about half a mile to three quarters of a mile away. On the top of the hill where all the rich people lived, he had his palace. And from Caiaphas's, or from Pilate, the temple area where the Romans would have tried him, it's about a half mile, three quarters of a mile to walk up there, up the hill. In fact, when you're there in Jerusalem, if you get a chance to go, they have uncovered a home which they believe to be Caiaphas. They found inscriptions on the seal of the family of Caiaphas. And they've got an incense business they found in the basement of his house. And, of course, they've got the actual Roman pavement in which would have been in the area of the courtyard where Jesus was tried. And some of the inscriptions on the stone that the soldiers have. It's a fascinating find. And they also have some of the remains that they found, or at least they've ascertained from historical records, where Herod's palace was. So he finds a way out, and so he sent him to Herod. which, of course, as a politician, it's shrewd. He's getting out of the problem, and he's also making friends with Herod, honoring him. Well, so we see three trials already with the Jewish people. Now the first trial with Pilate has ended now, and now he's going to the second Roman trial, or the fifth trial, which would have been sending him to Herod. Now Herod is an interesting guy. When Herod saw Jesus, he says he was exceedingly glad, because he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Now this gives you a little insight into Herod's life, his attitude. In AD 4, his father, Herod the Great, died. That was shortly after he had, remember, killed all those little babies in Bethlehem, trying in his madness to destroy the Messiah. And so his sons were made fourth rulers over various areas. Herod Antipas was one of them, and he was made a tetrarch over Galilee area. And he had his problems. When he saw his brother Philip's wife Herodias, he wanted her. He longed for her. She must have been beautiful, or maybe her personality, or something about her, that he actually broke off his engagement with King Aretas' daughter and sent her running, and then married his brother's wife. While they were still married, he married her. So, I mean, totally broke the law and broke the religious law. And John the Baptist, of course, was, you know, a preacher of righteousness, and he told it like it was. He said to Herod, you know, it's wrong what you're doing. Well, in those days, you say that to a king, you can get thrown into jail, and that's exactly what happened to John the Baptist. And eventually, Herodias arranged for the setup for John to be beheaded. Now, this Herod was also the same one that Jesus said when Herod wanted to see him before, and he sent some people after to arrest Jesus, or people actually found out that Herod wanted to try to capture him. Jesus told the servants of Herod, he says, you go tell that sly fox that I'll be here today and tomorrow, and the third day I'm going to Jerusalem. In other words, you know, in my own time, there's a plan, and you're going to have nothing to do with it. So he'd already squared off with Herod once. But Herod was very interesting. He heard all these miracles, and he just wanted to see a miracle. You know, he was a guy that was just curious. It's amazing the different people that you see and how they're interacting with Jesus. In fact, what I want you to be sensitive to when you're reading this, what I want you to really notice is that Jesus is on trial. But is he really? Or is it really, from God's perspective, each of these people that are on trial? Aren't they being tested? Just as you will be on trial one day for what you do with the Son of Man, the Son of God, Jesus, the Messiah. What decision will you come up about him? Notice the differences. The disciples came to know him, and so they loved him. The leaders feared his influence, so they openly attacked him. Pilate was just indifferent. He's busy with all these other things. He doesn't care about it. Herod seems to be just one who's bored and just wants some amusement. Show me a miracle. It's amazing that these types of people, it's a good cross-section of America and the world today. You've got those who've come to know him, and hey, you can't help but love him once you get to know him. You can't help it. The more you get to know Jesus, the more you will love him. But then there are those who hate him. They misunderstand him. They don't understand this whole idea of religion, and they'll openly attack it. Then there are those like Pilate who are just indifferent. You know, they don't bother me with this stuff. You take him and judge him. I don't want to hear this stuff. I'm not interested in religion. I'm not interested in this stuff. And then there are those like Herod who, in their own heart and conscience, though they have these religious impressions. In fact, Herod loved to hear John. When John was arrested and put in prison, he'd secretly go down there and he'd hear him. And the Bible says he liked to hear him. But he'd get a little afraid when John would start speaking about judgment. Though he loved to hear John, it wasn't enough to change. And there are people that are like that. They love to come to church and feel religious and feel that you know, warm feeling of being in fellowship and the worship and everything, but not enough to change their life. They're still living like they were before they became a Christian and came to church, there really doesn't seem to be any change. We have to examine our heart. I mean, do we fit? Which category do we fit in here? Because these kind of are a good cross-section of everyone in this country. You know, here is Herod. Herod's hoping to see a miracle, so he questions him with many words, and he answers him, notice, what does he do? But he answered him nothing. Jesus was silent. He had nothing to say to Herod. Why is that? Earlier we looked at what Herod had done, and basically when John the Baptist had come to him, John represented the voice of God in his life, and God was speaking to Herod through John. Herod made a decision. When he silenced John's voice, he silenced God's voice in his life. He made a choice at that point. He had the opportunity, and he rejected it. And you know, there's something funny that happens. When you continue to refuse to hear God, one day you will not be able to hear Him. I pray that your heart would never become so hard, your conscience could be so seared, your love for the truth could become so cold that it would be impossible for you to understand and hear, and that God would no longer speak to you. Here, this is judgment right here. The judgment has been made. He answered him nothing. He had nothing to say to Herod. Herod, you didn't listen to the first prophet who was sent to you. You're not going to listen to me, so I'm not going to bother. What an opportunity Herod wasted. Good question for us. Do we waste the opportunities that God speaks to us? Do we waste them? Maybe in your own life you think, well, you know, I'm not that consistent in reading the Bible. You know, there are people in other countries that don't have the freedoms we have. You can't even imagine. I mean, I saw it from my very own eyes, some of the people we met in Africa that didn't have a Bible, people that we met in India that did not have a Bible and they were just hungry. And they would find a scrap of piece of paper somewhere, and they would find someone that had a Bible, and they would go over to their home and they'd copy meticulously in such tiny lettering, you almost needed a magnifying glass, but they only had so much paper, so they wanted not to waste it. They'd copy it, and it looked just to me, it looked like a gray piece of paper until you look closer, and oh, that's writing. They loved the Word so much. Though they didn't have a Bible, they went to great lengths and pains to get it, to hear from God. And yet, we have our Bibles, and when they leave on Sunday, they throw them in the back of their car, and they'll pick them up next Sunday when they come. If they come next Sunday, because they're not that consistent either. Think about that. Think of the opportunities you might be wasting. And maybe some of you really, who really could benefit from getting deeper in your understanding of God, you don't take advantage of the opportunities of the many other fellowships that are here, the many small groups, the New Believers Fellowship, if you're a new believer, the home groups, which are so essential. Really getting some questions answered and just fellowshipping and getting to know others in the fellowship. Coming out to a midweek Bible study, especially as we're going through Romans. I mean, man, that is the epitome of God's whole plan of salvation in that one little book. That you could understand so much about what God has for you. But if you don't take advantage of, if you waste those opportunities, could be very much like Herod, who, though he heard, he didn't hear. Jesus had nothing to say to him. He'd already silenced God's voice in his life. And then Herod, or the chief priests and scribes, stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him and arrayed him in the gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Jesus, if you're not going to amuse me with any of your miracles, then I'll amuse myself at your expense. And so he does that. And they put a crown of thorns on him and jam it, those long thorns, into his skull. And they put this robe on him, and he's already been beaten. His face was probably already puffy and bruised, and probably had to squint to see through his eyes because he would have been beaten so much. Bible says that they plucked out his beard. They did so many things to him and mocking him. In fact, Isaiah verse 53 tells us that he was more marred than any other man, that he didn't even appear as a man. His visage was so damaged that he didn't even look like a man. By the time he gets up on the cross, he doesn't even resemble a human being. He's so tortured. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they'd been at enmity or angry with each other. But now they're friends. Pilate honored him by sending him Jesus, and Herod reciprocated by treating Jesus cruelly, and now they're friends. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You know, you brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence," in other words, thoroughly gone over all the facts, you were here, you heard everything, "I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent him back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, he knew they wanted blood. So it would have been right for him at that point, just, you know, "Jesus, you're free to go." But he's wanting to compromise with these leaders. So he said, I'll scourge him, which is the term chastise. Literally, he's going to scourge him, which the soldiers would actually take this staff with strips of leather attached, in which the ends were tied pieces of broken bone and glass and rock and anything that was sharp or cutting. And they would take this thing and they would strap a man, you know, around a pole so he couldn't, you know, his hands were like tied and his back was exposed. And they would take that thing and just rip it across the back and then pull it. And literally, by the time they were done with 39 of those stripes, his back would have looked like raw hamburger by the time they were done with it. I mean, some of the movies that we see Jesus up on the cross, it looks like he just had his hair blown dry, and, you know, I mean, it doesn't cut it. It's, you know, it doesn't do it. You got to imagine what he really would have looked like. And so he's saying he's going to do this. He does this after all anyway, even before he crucifies him. And then he says, "For it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast." Luke abbreviates this whole thing that happened. Pilate's seeking another way to get out of this, and he's saying, "Well, look, I can release a guy to you. I've got a known insurrectionist and murderer here, Barabbas, and I've got Jesus, you know. I know. I'll put it up to the people." Because Pilate knew that it made no sense for them to bring him, Jesus, to be killed when Jesus was an insurrectionist, because, hey, the Jews hated the Romans anyway. They'd love the insurrectionists. They'd love these guys that caused Rome problems. Why would they bring an insurrectionist? It doesn't make sense. So he knew it was envy. And so because it was envy, he figured the crowds must love Jesus. He's probably heard a few things himself. Thinks, I know, if I give the crowd the choice, they'll choose Jesus and then I'll be done with this. So what happens is when he does this, in verse 18 it says, "They all cried out at once, saying, 'Away with this man and release to us Barabbas,' who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." Amazing, the crowd is crying out for Barabbas. Pilate was wrong. He assumed the crowd would ask for Jesus, but they're asking for Barabbas. How could this be? How could the crowd ask for Barabbas? How is that possible, considering just not even a week ago, they were saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David." They were lauding. They just came from the place where Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead after being dead for 4 days. They were amazed at his miracles and his power, and they're thinking he's the Messiah, and they're lauding and they're singing his praises just about 5 days ago. Now they're crying, "Crucify him." How is that possible? You know, there's a number of possible explanations. One is the people just didn't want to do anything that would please Pilate. They kind of felt Pilate wants Jesus released. Well, we'll do the opposite. I don't know if that would have been enough. I don't know if that's a good answer. It's a possibility. Their other possibility is that maybe Jesus disappointed them. When he came in on a donkey, they kind of thought, well, you know, we would have rather had him come in on a horse, you know, symbolizing conquering. He's going to come in as a Messiah and he's going to rid us of Rome. And they were just fickle. He didn't meet their expectations. You know, there are a great many people who get tired of the things of God because God has not met their expectations. God hasn't done it their way. I want it done my way. God, if you're going to help me, then this is what I want. If God doesn't come through, then, well, he didn't do what I wanted. He didn't do what I expected, so therefore I don't want anything to do with him. There are people like that. They're fickle. Their fancies aren't pleased. Their desires aren't met, and so therefore they turn on God. Could be that this is what's really happening with the people. But maybe that's not enough to answer it. Another possibility is that the leaders who stirred up the crowds, they must have done something to set this thing up. Maybe they lied with deception, saying, hey, if you ask for Barabbas, then that will be a good thing because then it'll force Jesus' hand. And if he is the Messiah, of course the Messiah can't be killed. So therefore you'll know he's the Messiah, because then he'll stretch forth and he'll break those bonds and he'll be delivered, and then you'll know he's the Messiah. So, I mean, it could have been a subtle thing. Now, that's just my speculation, and that might be totally wrong. It might be the result of having a burrito too late at night. But it's a possibility. The other possibility is, and it's most likely the probability, is that you've got to understand the hedge of protection around Jesus is gone. He's already resolved that in the garden he's going to lay down his life. He's prayed to the Father for his will to be done. The Father has lifted his hand back, and you can imagine all the demons of hell who know who he is are gathered together to incite this unruly mob and to demonically influence them to shout these horrible cries, "Crucify him." But you know, the hypocrisy from a political standpoint is astounding. Here, they're accusing Jesus of insurrection to have him killed, while they're asking for a known insurrectionist and murderer to be released. I mean, I'm sure Pilate was quite aware of this. But again, another travesty of justice. Well, then he said to them the third time, which was actually the fourth time Pilate's trying to get out of this, but the third time in succession. He says, "Why? What evil has he done? I found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and the voices of these men and that of the chief priests prevailed. In fact, it was becoming such a riot, Pilate knew he was in danger of having another thing to answer to Caesar for. He didn't want to endanger his job. So it says, "So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will." They prevail over Pilate. He is going to be crucified. You know, the sacrifice that Jesus is making is something that you can't... I mean, I look at him just willingly laying down his life when he could have stopped it at any moment. He made the ultimate sacrifice. And it really speaks to my heart. Maybe there's something that we need to evaluate here and ask for ourselves. If the Lord loved us so much, if he gave his life up for us, how could we not respond to that? And in fact, the other thing that's so important for us to see here is this horrible death. Why crucify? Why not just die a normal death? Wouldn't that have sufficed if they'd have just cut his head off or executed him painless, you know, just kill him? Why wouldn't that have been enough? Do you know it was necessary that he be crucified? Because the Bible speaks about one who is hung up on a cross or on a tree is one who is accursed of God. And it was necessary that he be accursed, because he took upon the sin of the world, and it was necessary that sin be paid for, and that Jesus became a curse that we might be set free. It was necessary he suffered this horrible death, horrible pain and suffering. But you know, the amazing thing is that some people still think, well, you know, if I'm a good person, you know, God will accept me. If I'm basically a nice person, I don't hurt my neighbors, I generally do well and I obey the law, and I can't imagine God sending me to hell. No, it's not that, folks. It's like God is doing everything. We're all going to hell. We're all destined for hell because we're all sinners. And God is doing everything he can to rescue us. Now, if there were any other way, if you could possibly say, well, okay, I can get to heaven because I'm a good person, why all this? Why would Jesus die? If there were any other way for you to get to heaven, this is all meaningless. God sent his own son into the world for nothing. If you could just waltz into heaven on the basis of your own good works. No, we got to understand the odiousness of our sin, the extent of our sin required this, and nothing else but this could answer. If there were any other system of religion, any other rigorous thing you could do to yourself, even if you could have your own life crucified and lift yourself up on a cross. And you know, there are some religiously motivated people who do all kinds of things and punishing themselves and crawling around the city on their knees, you know, in penance and you know, cutting themselves and all kinds of things to punish themselves for their sin. Folks, it's not enough. If it were, this would not have been necessary. But he made the ultimate sacrifice. David Livingstone, a missionary to Africa who gave his life up over there, said this. He said, "People talk of the sacrifice I've made in spending so much of my life in Africa. Can that be called a sacrifice which is simply paid back as a small part of the great debt owing to our God which we can never repay? Is it a sacrifice which brings its own reward of healthful activity and a consciousness of doing good, peace of mind, and a bright hope of a glorious destiny hereafter? Away with such a word, such a view, such a thought. It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it's a privilege. Anxiety, sickness, and suffering are danger now and then, with the foregoing of the common conveniences and charities of this life, may make us pause and cause the spirit to waver and sink. But let this be only for a moment. All these things are nothing when compared with the glory which shall be hereafter revealed in us and for us. I never make a sacrifice. I never made a sacrifice," he says, "of all this. We ought not to talk when we remember the great sacrifice which he made, who left his Father's throne on high and gave himself for us." You know, that is a response that I think is a necessary response for all of us, to say, "Lord, the least I can do is be available to you for what you have done for me." I pray that you, if you have not come to that place in your life of acknowledging Jesus as Lord, that you would really, really consider this. This is God's demonstration of his love toward you, that Christ died for the ungodly. And that's all of us. And when we acknowledge that, we can come into his presence with great joy when we believe on his Son and we accept that sacrifice he made. And now the Lord will forgive us of our sin, because there's a basis for forgiveness. Not our good works, but what Jesus did for you.